everybody. This is Armand DeMille with you at The Positive Mind. WBAI 99.5 FM on your dial. Bringing you ideas, concepts, and guests to help you lead a more positively minded life. And today we're going to talk a little more about irrationality and some of the things that happen to us when we are irrational. And I have a guest on the in the studio by phone today, Dr. Dan Ariely. Dan Ariely is a professor of behavioral economics at MIT, and he's a researcher, but he's written quite a fascinating book called Predictably Irrational. Let me see. Michael, do we have Dan with us?
I am here.
Oh, good. Good, Dan. Dan, fascinating book. And I want people to understand, we're always looking to predict and try to understand why people behave the way that they behave. You've done some tremendous work here. I'd like to start off with your work with placebos, just because it's something that's close to our hearts. Can you tell us a little about your experiments and about what you've done and how you came to all of this?
Sure. So I always found placebos to be amazingly interesting. I actually, my own introduction to behavioral economics happened because I was involved in an explosion many years ago, and I spent a long time in hospital. And one of the things that I remember, like every patient, I used to keep track of how much painkillers I took and how much I have left and so on. And I also kind of tried to keep in mind what other people were getting, just in case I was not getting enough and I could maybe beg the doctors for some more painkillers. And I remember some nights when some people used to scream and the nurses would come and give them an injection. They would quickly fall asleep. And I would ask the nurses, how did you give them? Didn't they pass the limit of their allocation for the day? And sometimes they would tell me that they just gave them placebo. They just gave them saline water, basically injection fluid, IV fluid. And, you know, it's one thing to hear about placebos. It's a completely different thing to know somebody is in the burn unit experiencing tremendous pain as I was experiencing it, screaming from it, and getting in injections with nothing but water and some salt and quickly falling asleep. And that's kind of an unbelievable experience.
So, now, Dan, let me get it straight. You were in a burn unit for 8 months, I think it was?
No, I was in a burn unit for almost 3 years.
3 years in a burn unit, having been burned practically over most of your body.
That's right.
While you were in Israel?
Yes.
And so here you are suffering one of the worst of all pains, you know, and you're going through this. And so medication is the kind of thing that will keep you sober and it'll keep you intact. But medication also of this kind can impair the healing. So they have to find some level where they give you just enough painkiller so as, you know, the minimal amount that you need.
That's right. At that time, you know, this was over 20 years ago. At that time, they were also more worried about people becoming addicted to narcotics. It turns out this particular worry was unfounded because of the incredible pain people were having doesn't really transfer to things afterward. So doctors used to be more reluctant to give painkillers. They're more outgoing with it right now. But the thing with the placebo was, you say, how can somebody get nothing and get pain relief? I mean, this was unbelievable. Now, years later, I started working from a different direction on the role of expectations people have.
Let me just go back 1 second. Did you, when you were in the burn hospital,
yep,
at any point when you were feeling restless, did you ask yourself, could you please inject me with a placebo?
You know, I never asked for that, and of course it wouldn't have worked, because if you know
it's
a placebo.
We wonder.
Yeah.
I wonder if it would or it wouldn't.
Yeah, and I never thought they did it to me, but in retrospect I was thinking a lot. Have they done this to me as well? I just don't know.
I understand. Okay, see, I'm sorry to interrupt you. Continue
no
with
problem.
What you're saying.
So then I started working on the effect of expectations, and I found out all these incredible effects of expectations. So, for example, when we give people two beers, one is a regular beer and one is beer with balsamic vinegar, and we say, try out these two and tell us which one you like more, we'll give you a whole picture of it. It turns out that the one with balsamic vinegar usually appeals to people more. That's when they don't know, when they just taste them. Turns out, you know, somehow balsamic vinegar makes beer better. But then to other people, we tell in advance, hey, here are two beers, one with balsamic vinegar, one without. Taste them and tell us which one you like better, which one you want the full picture of. Now people hate the one balsamic vinegar. Now it's an interesting thing, is that we have these expectations that beer with balsamic vinegar would taste terrible, and as a consequence, when we taste it, it actually does feel terrible, and the actual experiencing of it is not helpful enough to overcome our preconceptions. Now, this is basically the power of expectations. And I went back and I thought, you know, in placebo, it's all about the power of expectations. You expect something to be painful or to be relieving your pain, and it works. And it turns out in placebo, we know much about the physiology of placebo for pain. So here is how it works. When a physician comes and injects you with something, or you pop a pill, and you expect it to be a good pain relief, your body starts secreting a substance that is very much like morphine. So we have these opioids inside of our bodies. The thing is, we don't have exactly volitional control over them. You can't close your eyes and say, please, 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 can I have some painkillers? But when something comes from the outside world and invokes those, your body secretes a painkiller. So when you get a placebo injection, it's true, nothing comes from the injection, but the pain relief actually comes from within your body.
But it's not only with pain relief. They do the same thing with placebos with diet pills.
That's right. The placebo actually works in a lot of different ways. With pain, it's the one thing we know actually the physiology. We know exactly what substance is released, and we know how to block it and how not to block it. So we understand it in the best way. But there's evidence of placebo in a lot of things: antidepression, asthma, heart surgery, knee surgery, a ton of things.
We're talking with Dan Ariely, author of Predictably Irrational, fascinating book about people and their expectations and how expectations affect the outcome of your choices. We're going to be able to cover today some of the reasons why people choose what they choose and why they choose it, and some of the things that we don't expect, which is like why free things aren't always more appealing, and why there are certain things there are things about passion that we have yet to learn, and the power of pricing something, and why a 50-cent aspirin can do what a penny aspirin can't do. You know, why is it? Is that because, well, let's just stick with that one for a minute, Dan. Is that because of the expectations? A 50-cent aspirin nowadays, a $5 aspirin.
Exactly. So here's what we did. We brought people to the lab, and we said we have a new painkiller called Valadon RX that we're testing. And to make them feel like they're really in a medical testing facility, we took their blood pressure and their heart rate, and we asked them about their family and their personal medical history. And then we connected them to a machine that gave them electrical shocks. And we gave them a long set of electrical shocks. And after each of them, we said, so how painful was this? And how painful was this? And so on. Then we gave them a pill. This was the famous Valadon RX that they came to test. And we gave them a brochure about the pill. We asked them to swallow it with some water and to sit for 15 minutes next to some old Time and Newsweek magazine to make it really feel like a doctor's office. And then we and the second set of electrical shocks. And the basic result was that people experienced less pain in the second set compared to the first set. And that's just basically the general placebo effect. You're getting a pill that you think is going to be effective. Oh, by the way, I forgot to tell you, Valadon RX was vitamin C. So it had no effect, no real medicine effect. It just was about their expectation, and people got some expectation. Okay, that's all nice and good. Nothing terribly new here. What we also did was we gave people different brochures that described the medications. And we had four brochures. We had one brochure that said this medication was made in Cary, North Carolina, and it's expensive. One that said it was made in Cary, North Carolina, it was cheap. One that said it was made in Chaopin, China, and it's expensive. One that said it was made in Chaopin, China, and it was cheap. The question is, what will these two factors the price and country of origin cause people to believe about the medication, and hence will that also change the efficacy of the pill. And what we basically saw was a big effect for the price. The expensive painkillers worked much better. They relieved much more pain than the cheap painkillers. The effect of China was interesting. We thought it would also get people to feel less good about the medication, but it turns out it was actually a positive effect. But it was a positive effect only for the people from South Asian origin. And in retrospect, what I think was happening there is Chinese medicine has a very good association in general. We feel there's all kinds of healing and history and so on. So the people who got the Chinese medication thought slightly higher of it, and as a consequence, they got slightly better outcome. But the most important thing was, of course, the price has a huge effect on the efficacy.
Yes, so price, the more something costs, the better it is. Well, and, of course, even natural products, which they charge more money for when they say something is organic, you know, and it costs twice as much because it's organic, people consider it must be better because it's organic because it costs twice as much.
That's right. So partially it's the organic, partially it's the cost. We actually just started a new project on this. So it's early days. I can't tell you anything
concrete. I'll tell you a little bit.
Tell me the following. Would you prefer stone-grinded cookies or stone-ground flour or machine-grounded flour?
Oh, stone-ground flour, for sure.
Now, why?
I mean, because I see the stones grinding the flour, and I want the stones to ground it because it's more natural.
That's right. It's the natural. And the same thing goes for cosmetics. I see a lot of ads for cosmetics that say putting natural thing in it. Like, why would have nature intended for cucumbers and mango to be parts of cosmetics? Like, what is it about the natural? And I think what we see emerging from the data is that for things that are going to have an effect on our system, for things that we digest or put on our skin or become part of us, we believe that somehow the modern world has overdone it, that the old approach for medicine are better, that our body was somehow designed for an 18th century technology.
And so, therefore, if we take organic materials, which is where it all started.
That's right.
Right? It all started with organic materials, and then they took and they eventually created chemicals that were more specific than the organic chemicals. So instead of taking Datura Sambosa and taking an entire plant or acetoxycyclohexamide and squeezing out a couple of ounces of juice,
that's right.
We decided to go directly to the chemical itself. And now that we have the chemical itself, we want to add some mushrooms because it makes it more romantic, because it somehow makes it sound like it's more natural and therefore your body's going to welcome it more.
That's right. It's exactly about the belief of the body welcoming it. That I think is the crux of it. Well, you know, when we go to cars or computers, nobody wants old stuff, old technology. But with our bodies, we believe our body is more welcoming from old technology than new technology. And you can think about engineered food in this way, right? Why is the corn that has been developed naturally necessarily going to be better than engineered developed corn? Of course, we can make terrible engineered food, but it doesn't necessarily mean that it will be worse. But I think we have a belief that our body is just not designed for all this technology.
There's some kind of a belief that if you go with engineered food, the engineering will get out of whack. You know, that it's somehow, you know, if it's natural, it can't get out of whack.
That's right.
So we don't think of retroviruses and things like that, which do get out of whack. You know, but it's like we kind of consider we want to be able to stay this natural course. Talk about your social security number experiments, because I find those fascinating.
This is maybe one of my favorite experiments. So I go to a big class of students, and by the way, I've done it many, many times, and I ask each of them for the last two digits of their social security number. So mine is 69. What's yours?
74.
74, okay. So everybody writes down the last two digits of the social security number. And then what happened? I pass six products around. I pass some bottles of wine, some computer accessories, some books, some chocolates, and everybody looks at those and evaluates them. And then I say, would you pay a price set by the last two digits of your social security number for each of those products? Hypothetically, yes or no. So will I pay $79 for each of those things? Would somebody that have a social security number ending at 14 pay $14 for each of those? People say yes, no, whatever they want. And then I say, okay, now we're going to have an auction. It will be for real. The winner of the auction will actually get the product and pay for it. So let's do it. Everybody submits their bid. We find the highest bidder. They win the product. They pay the money. Everybody goes home happy. And then I calculate the relationship between people's social security number and their bids, how much they really were willing to pay for it. And it turns out that people with higher ending social security numbers are willing to pay a lot more, sometimes hundreds of percent more than people with low ending social security number. Now, at this point, you must be worried that if you have a high ending social security number, you spend too much on everything in life. But of course, it has nothing to do with social security number. The trick here is that once we get people to think once about a problem in a certain price range, that thought remains with them for a little bit too long, and therefore it also influences their next decision. So I just answered about something in the range of $79 and a bottle of wine. And I said, that's too much. But when I say, how much would I pay? I said, well, I just said $79 was too much. Maybe I'll say I'll pay $70 or $65. But I end up being close to that number. Whereas somebody who started at 12 said, well, I just said I'll pay $12 for it. How much would I pay? Well, maybe 15 or maybe 18. And people stay too close to their initial decision because it stays with them and penetrates them.
Do you think there are any of these factors are at work in people's selection of relationships? This whole idea of the mental set being kind of a certain way that makes you make your choices?
You mean in a relationship? Romantic relationship?
Yeah, romantic relationships.
Oh, absolutely. You know, in fact, I think romantic relationships are some of the hardest type of decisions, and as a consequence, we have a lot of inherent mistakes in those.
And
in
what do you think the inherent mistakes are?
Well, you see, the thing is that we were not designed to be rational, but the world today expects us to be rational. And maybe the best example to think about is emotions. Think about what used to be the role of emotions. If you were an animal in the jungle a million years ago, and you were seeing a tiger, what do you want to do? Do you want to stop and think and say, should I stay, should I go, what's the cost, what's the benefit? Of course not. You want to create a system where the emotions take over, they make you run as fast as you can without thinking. Now, we still have these emotions, and they still work in the same way. They're still invoked by something else in the world. We can't generate them. We need something outside of us to generate the emotion. They still take over our thinking, but now they get us to behave in all kinds of ways. Now, we don't have tigers. Now we get angry when we lose money in the stock market, when somebody cuts in front of us in the highway, when our spouse says something. But emotions still take over us. Now they just get us to make big mistakes. So let's think about relationship. We've done some research on how much do we really know ourselves. So you know, of course, the story of Jekyll and Hyde. And the idea was that are we all a little bit of Jekyll and Hyde? And the thing is that not only are we different people, we actually don't know how different we would become. So for example, have you ever gone to a supermarket hungry and as a consequence bought too much food?
Absolutely.
Have you learned after doing it once never to do it again?
I have learned to eat before I go to the supermarket.
Oh, very good. But this is actually very smart. So you eat before you go to the supermarket.
That's right.
Because you know that if you'll be at the supermarket hungry, you will lose the battle.
Not lose the battle, but my choices will be based on chemical reactions that I'll have in my body.
That's right.
And seeing certain things. Like if I see something, I'm going to salivate and I'm going to set off certain things that are going to be ready to digest the thing I'm seeing. And it's going to make me hungry.
That's right. So I shop
more efficiently if I eat beforehand.
That's right. But you can't correct it. Once you get into the supermarket hungry, you can't undo the effect of hunger. You can't reason yourself out of it. It's not enough.
Right.
So we wanted to examine this, and we decided to do it in the domain of sexual arousal, which is, you know, A, very important, and B, the source of much of the difficulties in society. So we got a group of young undergrads to say the following. We say, when you're in a state of arousal, when you're aroused, like when you're in the supermarket or when you're, you know, in the case of hunger, but you're aroused sexually, which of those following activities will you enjoy? And we gave them a whole range of activities, ranging from kind of standard activities to kinky, you know, including being tied up, multiple partners, contacts with animals, all kinds of stuff. And then, but in all cases, we asked them, how would you behave when you're aroused? What would you enjoy when you're aroused? Then we asked them about condom use. Here's a situation, you're alone in a room with a woman, you're both half naked, you just realize you don't have a condom. Do you go down to get one? Do you go to the pharmacy to get one? And finally, we asked them about activities we generally call date rape. Those range from all the way from, would you tell a woman you love her even if you don't to increase the chance she'll go to bed with you? Would you buy her an expensive meal? Would you get her drunk, drugged? Would you try to have sex even if she says no? Okay, so all of these people answered these questions, and they basically said they have kind of conservative sexual preferences, they'll always wear condoms and always respect women. Then we did the same test, but this time we got the same people to be aroused. How did we do it? We gave them a little bit of pornography, and we asked them to stimulate themselves a little bit. And when they got to a certain level of arousal, they got asked the same questions. But again, everybody in the experiment was trying to predict how they would behave when aroused. But some people had the privilege of being aroused, and sometimes they didn't. And now, the aroused people gave us vastly different answers. So different that you would wonder if it's the same people. Now they would say they would enjoy a whole range of activities quite a lot. They could see themselves not caring much about condoms and, of course, not respecting women. And we call this the intra-empathy gap. Empathy is usually how much you understand other people. Intra-empathy is the issue of how much do you understand yourself when you're under the influence of some emotional state. And the answer is, we don't know ourselves very much.
So I think what you're saying, Dan, is that the emotional state is really the problem, and that the rational state is the solution. That if you could be rational and get rid of emotional states, you would then conduct your life better.
Well, you know, I think that's kind of tricky because, you know, I don't think we all want to be Spock, like, you know, Mr. Spock from Star Trek all the time.
Well, I'm just thinking about you. I'm thinking about how you can do experiments like watching people get stimulated and then they get aroused and you go in and you ask them questions while they're aroused. Well, now would you like some pizza? You know, you know. So I imagine that you have a great appreciation of the rational mind.
Yeah.
Which I think must have saved you when you were in that burn unit. Thank God for your rational mind.
I think that's correct. Although I have to tell you that experiencing things in the burn unit is incredibly, incredibly difficult. By the way,
I wrote, as well.
Yeah, I wrote an essay on life in hospital. It's not a part of my book, but it's on my website in case somebody wants to.
Oh, good. What is your website, by the way, Dan?
It's predictablyirrational.com.
Okay, now let me go back for a second, Dan. With your appreciation, and I mean, if people got the book, Predictably Irrational, they would read about different experiments you've done, the ones with chocolate, so on and so forth. All of those are fascinating. But now you have to have some kind of love relationship, and I know what it's like. A man named Dan Ariely, if he has a love relationship, he's going to find somebody who is deeply emotional. Because generally it tends to be that the most rational people find the most emotional people. Is that true?
I don't know. I mean, I have to say my wife is an extraordinary person. In fact, anybody who would be willing to marry me has to be.
Right, but extraordinarily dedicated emotionally, your wife must be.
That's right.
See, so what I'm saying is, isn't it amazing how you, the amazingly rational one, chooses somebody who's the deeply emotional one, almost proving that what we need is a balance between the two, although it would look like it makes the most sense in the world to just be logical.
Yeah, I think that's a very good point. I mean, we talk about rationality and irrationality as if rationality is always better. And it's of course the case that it doesn't necessarily maximize a real satisfaction from life or enjoyment of life. And you know what I hope people would get from my book or from this type of research or other things like it is basically three things. The first one is an appreciation for how interesting and fascinating we are, right? How quirky and odd but also interesting we are. The second one is to examine our life through a lens of, here's a list of possible mistakes we might be making. Here's the list we make in terms of financial decision, romantic decision, and eating and healthcare and so on, and not necessarily trying to fix everything, but to use that as a lens to figure out where are the big mistakes, where are the things that might actually hurt us more than help us, and try to fix those things. And finally, I think that the biggest challenge is for policy and business. You know, we design a lot of processes, a lot of programs. Think about something like mortgages or health insurance, retirement plans, annuities. All of those things assume people are rational. But what if, as all of our experiments show, people are irrational? How do you design a healthcare system? How do you design a hospital? How do you design a tax system that takes into account the irrationality of people and try to help them do better? And that's kind of the big interesting challenge out there.
Well, I think that's a major contribution that you make in that suggestion, Dan. My guest is Dan Ariely. The book is Predictably Irrational. It's kind of fascinating when you consider it. Of course, now we have to wonder what it would be like to be totally rational. Well, if you're totally rational, you know what you should do? Go out and marry somebody who is extremely passionate. Because then the two of them will go together. I want to thank you very much for being with us, Dan.
My pleasure. It's been delightful.
The website, one more time?
PredictablyIrrational.com.
PredictablyIrrational.com. Thanks for being with us.
My pleasure.
Mm-hmm. This is Armand DeMille with you with The Positive Mind. When we come back, we're going to be continuing our series today because I want to talk about abandonment fears. Fears of abandonment that people have and how abandonment relates to what we're talking about. Fear of abandonment, abandophobia, stuff like that. And we're going to be continuing that as soon as we get back from our brief break. And this is Armand DeMille with you with The Positive Mind, WBAI 99.5 FM. We'll take a short break and we'll be back with you very shortly.
I'm to the place where I don't know my name. It's a world for the lonely, gone insane. I brought along the little pieces of me he left behind. Got no place to go but crazy.
Loretta Lynn. No place to go but crazy, because I'm crazy out of my mind. Crazy out of my mind. That's kind of such an amazing thing. We were just speaking with Dan Ariely, Predictably Irrational. And we've also been talking this week about the fear of rejection, fear of different things that seem to be rejection sensitivity we spoke about. I want to talk about the fear of abandonment. A fear of abandonment. Get this, abandonment. You know, it sounds like something that should be used as a breath freshener. Yeah, let me have one of those abandonments, you know. The fear of being left all alone to cope in a hard world, that's universal. We could see that built into our chemistry. Because as we said during this week, there is a universal bonding. There's a kind of a human bonding. It is the human bonding that helped the human species survive. Therefore, abandonment is a major threat. If you're left alone in, you know, out in on the savannah, and a group of Tyrannosaurus come along just passing by, you don't have much of a chance. But if you've got a buddy there with a cell phone who calls you up and says, watch out, Tyrannosaurus is coming, you got a better chance of getting out of the mess. So we don't want to be alone. It's built that way. There are people whose lives are so controlled by this fear that they get in trouble. They're so afraid of being abandoned. It's almost like they get extra DNA, extra abandonment juice. These people don't trust their own abilities to cope by themselves. That's kind of the main theme of it. Can you get by yourself? If everybody leaves you, if you left everybody, if you walked away, could you walk to another country and somehow get by? Just get through. Can you live? The people who don't trust their abilities to cope by themselves have a great fear of being left by other people. Because the expression is left alone. While it's fine to be interdependent with others in life, it's important to be your own person and know where you're going, whether or not there are always people around you to support you. You have to have some idea of an independent direction in life, that it's your choice. If you're threatened with having to be alone, those whose lives are controlled by the fear of abandonment tend to compulsively reach out to find someone, anyone, to have them around. There are many people who have a great fear of abandonment who are attracted to people who are drug and alcohol dependent. One of the things about having somebody who is drug and alcohol dependent is you know they're going to need you. You know they're going to be around. You know they're not going to leave you. They may panic if somebody doesn't call right back, the people who have a great fear of this. Or they may panic if somebody's late for a meeting. Sometimes the efforts are not to be alone can be really desperate and extreme. Are you one of those folks? You have this kind of desperation about being alone. The fearful one can become angry, threatening, pleading, blackmailing, all in an effort to lock the other people into them. You can't leave me. Emotional blackmailing may even get to the point of including threats like, I'll kill myself if you leave. A person who fears abandonment may also have an attitude that I may never do anything to bother or upset important people in my life. I must keep them happy to keep myself safe. So there are many people who fear abandonment who turn out to be kind of doormats. You know, they are servers, they are givers. Question, very often when I meet people who compulsively give, they're very nice and they're always giving, giving, giving. I wonder to myself, is this person terrified of being abandoned? It's part of why they're giving so much, that they're afraid of being alone. They may offer to do unpleasant jobs, or they may offer to do the dishes, you know, take out the garbage. Sometimes, you know, it may involve being a loud, nutty entertainer. There are those who may always be departing from relationships to avoid rejection, too. they immediately start reaching out. They drop relationships quick. As soon as they sense that a person is going to drop them, they pick up another relationship. There are people I know who always have relationships in reserve. See, if you're a man going out with a woman and she's your primary woman, you got a secondary person right behind who you're seeing occasionally ready to take the spot. And women who do that also. In relationship, a person is always asking, the person who is afraid of abandonment is always asking the question, do you love me? Do you really, really love me? Promise you'll never leave. Can we do every single thing together? You know, can we just, you know, be more tight? Can we be more of a collective? And the more you do it, of course, the more it pushes the other person away. And as it pushes them away, it brings up your fear of abandonment because you don't know why, but your desperation is pushing them. This is Armand DeMille with you talking about the fear of abandonment. People with major abandonment fear generally have a weakened sense of self. And they feel more happy, confident, and real when someone else is there to prop them up, to protect them against whatever ills there are in life. So it leads us to the usage of a concept. And I'm going to just use the word, and to tell you, I don't take it too seriously, but abandahol. Abandaholism, you know? You've heard of foodaholism, workaholism, shopaholism, alcoholism. You've heard of those. Here's another one. It's an insidious behavior pattern, abandaholism. Abandaholism is a tendency to become attracted to unavailable partners. That's all it is. An abandaholic is that person who is finding the person who is not available and finding themselves attached to him. Many abandonment survivors are caught up in this painful pattern. Abandonholism is similar to the other oholisms, you know, but instead of being addicted to a substance, you're addicted to the emotional drama of heartbreak. Now, doesn't that sound interesting? Imagine being addicted to the emotional drama of heartbreak. Well, it kind of goes back to what Dan Ariely was saying a few minutes ago. There seem to be pain mechanisms that secrete certain nice, pleasant feelings when we have pain and stress. The person who is an abandonholic, in a way, is producing their own pain by bringing themselves into a pain-filled relationship. Now, of course, if you look at them, they're crying and they're in such grief and they look like they're having a terrible time. But if they were, why would they do it a second time? You know, if you go to, if a dog is walking along and he puts his foot on a hot stove, he pulls his foot away, you know, he doesn't go near that hot stove a second time. No, humans who repeat patterns are getting something from the repetition of their patterns. And the thing that you will be getting is not just a repetition compulsion, but there is something in the pain itself that makes you feel secure. The person who is addicted to the emotional drama of heartbreak is afraid of abandonment, and they pursued the hard-to-get partners to keep this romantic intensity going and to keep the body's love chemicals and stress hormones flowing. But how does a person deal with it when they finally can't get it? They switch it over to someone else, and they keep trying to get someone else. But you see, there's a wonderful thing about it. If you fall in love with someone who is not available, and they are not available, they can never truly leave you. If you fall in love with somebody who is available, then you have to deal with your fear. What makes someone an abandonholic? Abandonholism sets in when you've been hurt so many times that you've come to equate insecurity with love. Unless you're pursuing someone you're insecure about, you don't feel in love. In love is insecurity. Conversely, when someone comes along who wants to be with you, that person's availability fails to arouse you anymore. And the required level of insecurity is not there. And because they're available, or they say they're available, or they claim a true love for you, or you see that they're really dedicated to you, you get turned off sexually, or you get turned off to them, you know? They're not the good ones. The good ones are the ones who are at a distance. And you see it all over the place. The more available they are, the more predictable they are, the less of a turn-on they are. So, if you can't find those yearning, lovesick feelings, then you don't feel attracted. So you keep pursuing the unavailable ones. You become psychobiologically addicted to the high-state trauma of an emotional challenge and the love chemicals that go with it. Abandonholism is driven by both fear of abandonment. Now get this other one. Engulfophobia. I love making up these words. Which is the fear of engulfment. Now this is, as silly as it sounds, a true thing. When you're attracted to someone, it arouses a fear of losing that person. That's one thing. This fear causes you to become clingy and needy. You try to hide your insecurity, but your desperation shows through, causing your partner to lose romantic interest in you, because as soon as you become desperate, the partner loses interest in you, invariably. They sense your emotional suction cups aim straight towards them. And so this, it scares people away. What does it scare away? When we were little, we somehow had two potentials, and especially men who had overprotective mothers go through this fear of engulfment. It's almost as if your parent would have engulfed you if you let them. You ever get that feeling from your mother? Mom would kind of, come over here, let me give you a kiss. And why is the boy running away? Why is the kid running away from mom's kisses? Why does he not want to be that close to mom? Because this fear of engulfment is part of your survival mechanism. It's what makes a person leave the nest. They are built with an aversion to being too close and too comfortable at home. You are built as a child, as you mature, as you become of age where you have to go out on your own. There's enough chemistry that is driving you away from finding comfort in the home nest. And the way it's built in is there's a kind of sense of suffocation that goes along with being engulfed. If your mother wants you there too much, you run away. And you run away because you don't even know why you're running away. You know, you could feel it when they hug you. If your mom or your pop hugs you and you feel like, I just got to get out of here. I can't breathe, is what you say to them. Truth of it is, you're having a panic attack because you have a fear of engulfment. The fear of engulfment is at that other end of the spectrum, you know. It occurs when someone is pursuing you and you're the one pulling back. You feel engulfed by that person's desire to be with you. Your fear of engulfment kicks in, you panic. You may even develop physical symptoms, emotional symptoms. You find some reason to get away. You could be say, oh, I'm hurting, I have an infection, I mean, you know, any number of things that you could say just to get away. Fear of engulfment is one of the most common causes for the demise of new relationships. But it's carefully disguised in excuses like, well, he just didn't turn me on anymore, you know, or I don't feel any chemistry anymore, or I wanted to do more exercise, but he was more sedentary, or just things like that. Abandonholics tend to swing back and forth between fear of abandonment and fear of engulfment, both. You're either pursuing hard-to-get lovers, or you're feeling turned off by somebody who's interested in you. Now, what a way to live. And we know many of you out there listening, and I've seen a lot of people who are just like that. You want somebody who's not available, and then when somebody comes over who is available, you have a fear that they're going to engulf you. That means you got a lot of work to do. You got to clear this stuff up, because this stuff comes clearly out of your early childhood experience. What is abandophobism? Right? Here's another word. Abandophobics are so afraid of rejection that they avoid relationships altogether. I thought for a minute that Dan Ariely was going to tell me he had no time for relationships because he was so rational. Do you know what I mean? Avandophobics act out of their fear of abandonment by remaining socially isolated or by appearing to search for someone when in fact they're pursuing people who are unattainable. There's a little abandophobism in every abandaholic, in every person who is afraid of, who is attracted to something that is a fight over abandonment. There's also this kind of fear. Negative attraction to more compelling than a positive one. You only feel attracted when you're in pursuit. You wouldn't join any club who would have you as a member. So you're always reaching out for something out of reach. It's the only way. And if he's there for you, and he tends to be there for you, you turn off. How do abandonholism and abandophobia set in, you know? Well, these patterns may have been cast in childhood. You struggle to get more attention from your parents, and you were left feeling unfulfilled, which caused you to doubt your self-worth. That's one way. Over time, you internalize this craving for approval, and you learn to idealize others at your own expense. And it became a pattern in your own love relationships. Now, as an adult, you recreate the scenario by giving your love partners all of your power, elevating them above yourself, recreating those old familiar yearnings you grew accustomed to as a child. Feeling emotionally deprived and less than is what you've come to expect. So why, my friends, do you think the insecurity lingers? This is Armand DeMille with you with The Positive Mind. We're talking about fear of abandonment today. Abandonholism, I'm calling it. Abandophobia, your fear of being abandoned. Recent scientific research shows us that rather than dissipate, fear tends to incubate. See, fear doesn't dissipate, it incubates. It gains intensity over time. Insecurity increases with each romantic rejection, causing you to look for others for something you've become too powerless to give yourself, which is esteem. When you seek acceptance from a withholding partner, you place yourself in a one-down position, recreating the unequal dynamics you had with your parents or your peers. You know, you choreograph this scenario over and over again. Conversely, when you're unable to feel anything when someone freely admires you or appreciates you, the abandonment compulsion is insidious. You didn't know it was developing until now. You didn't even have a name for it. You know, but there is this fear of abandonment, and it runs your life. Now, on the other side of it, and just one more aspect of it, if you're a hardcore abandonholic, you're drawn to a kind of love that's highly combustible. The hottest sex is when you're trying to seduce a hard-to-get lover. Insecurity becomes your favorite aphrodisiac. In order to get turned on, you need to be insecure. And you won't get turned on if you're secure. It's that simple. Now, you may say, oh, no, no, when he looks in my eyes and we linger, that's when I feel the most turned on. Yes, yes, yes. But that's one part of it. But mainly, it's the unavailability. It's mainly the distance that is more attractive. The hard-to-get lover. Insecurity becomes your favorite aphrodisiac. The intoxicated states are produced when you sense emotional danger, the danger of your love's propensity to abandon you the minute you get attached. You know, jealousy is such a factor for so many people because they hate being jealous, but it also turns you on. The fact that you may lose your mate to someone else is also a turn on. If someone flirts with your mate, it might be a turn on, even though it may make you very angry. At the other end of the seesaw, you turn off and you shut down when you happen to successfully win somebody's love. And if your lover succumbs to your charms, heaven forbid, you suddenly feel too comfortable, too sure of him to stay interested. There's not enough challenge to sustain your sexual energy. You interpret your turn on as he's not being right to you. You start demanding, saying we need more variation in our relationship. We need more things to go on here. We need to do new things. What's really happening is you're scared. by what is. If you're an abandonaholic, following your gut is probably what gets you in the most trouble. This is one of the cases where predictable irrationality comes in. Your gut gets you to pursue someone who makes your heart go pitter-pat, not because he's the right one, because he arouses fear of abandonment. And your gut gets you to avoid someone who is truly trustworthy, because he doesn't press the right insecurity buttons. You need to be insecure. If you know that about yourself, and you know that about yourself, it's something to work on. Enrich your mind. Follow your wisdom. But until you overcome your abandonment compulsion, don't follow your gut. It'll only get you in trouble. Because your gut tells you that unavailable people are attractive and the most desirable. This is Armand DeMille with you, with the positive mind. So we've been talking about the fear of abandonment. We talked about rejection sensitivity. And we talked about all these things today, this week. You know, kind of a remarkable thing. I mean, it's a lot of good information. I wish you could give it to some of the young teenagers who are trying to learn about how to be in life. Can you imagine? I mean, what's it like to be in this world? Who teaches you about relationships? Who teaches you about yourself? Who teaches you about your emotions? I mean, you have people like Dan Ariely running around getting your half aroused and going in and asking you questions. You know, is that what your professors are doing? They're trying to learn from you? I want people to get their wisdom as part of their learning. I want you to learn about love before you commit the farm, you know, before you sign everything over. Learn about yourself. Learn about your compulsions. Learn about your addictions. Learn about your fears. Learn to clear them out so that you could be just better for yourself. This is Armand DeMille with you at The Positive Mind. I am going to, I'll be back with you on Tuesday at 1 p.m., and you can send me an email, armand@thepositivemind.com. ARMAND @thepositivemind.com. Send me an email there, or go, if you want to hear today's program, you can go to WBAI.org or the website, thepositivemind.com. I'll be back with you on Tuesday at 1 p.m., my friends.
Tuesdays, Wednesdays, and Thursdays at 1 o'clock. You are tuned to 99.5 FM, WBAI, and WBAI.org, coming up at 2 p.m. Perspective.
I don't just talk to my boy, to me.